from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A massive distributed denial of service cyber attack hit the internet hard on Friday, taking out a huge chunk of the web. It slowed traffic online to a halt, blocking major websites for millions of users. The attack method was unprecedented. Hackers used the so-called Internet of Things, the connected devices in your home, webcams, DVRs, and turned them into an army of attackers used against a major internet service. The hacker's identity and motive are unknown, but everyone can now see a new vulnerability laid bare. This hour on Point, what just happened on the internet? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you live in a connected home? Have you ever worried that your television, your alarm system, your garage door opener could become tools for hackers? Can we count on the internet? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll look at the AT&T and Time Warner merger. But first, joining me now from New York is William Turton. He's a staff writer on cybersecurity for Gizmodo. He's been writing about the Dyn denial of service attack last Friday. William Turton, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about a lot of big websites in the U.S. and some beyond. Amazon, Twitter, CNN, PayPal, Spotify, I think 6,000 or something like that in total, which were gummed up for the better part of the day. Am I right?
Yeah, a whole host of websites.
And the vector of attack, as they're now saying, the Internet of Things. We're reading about webcams. We're reading about DVRs. Do we know what else? What other kinds of devices, if any, were employed?
So we're not sure on what specific devices are used, but we do know one thing, and that the majority of the devices utilized in this botnet attack came from one manufacturer, a Chinese manufacturer, that had weak security settings. Essentially, they had a hardwired password into all of these devices that were unsecured on an open internet so that a hacker could find these devices that all had the same hardwired password. It's like 4 or 5 digits long, and they could take over these devices and then use them in their botnet army to send a massive distributed denial-of-service attack.
This is Hongqiao Chiongmai Technology, I guess, and there's news today that they are, issuing a huge recall of a bunch of these devices.
Yeah, they're issuing a huge recall. They're also threatening some legal threats against publications that are mentioning that their devices were used in this botnet.
Sorry about that, but there's the news. They've got the recall going on. And so this was all aimed at a company called Dyn out of New Hampshire that's sort of a big phone book for the internet. You ask for a particular site, they get you to it. And when that was gummed up, down came all these major sites.
Right. So Dyn runs something called DNS. And what DNS is, it basically routes when you type in a URL into a browser. What DNS does is that it finds the place on the internet where that website is located. You're right. It's just like a phone book. So it takes you there. And so when the DNS is down, when you type a URL into a browser,
New York Times or CNN or PayPal. Right. You're just not going to get there.
Right.
And it was down because all of these little gizmos around the country, maybe around the world, the botnet army out there, unbeknownst to their owners, presumably, who they have no idea, they are all calling on Dyn. They're all pinging it and just overwhelming it. Is that right?
Right. So distributed denial of service attacks basically work by flooding the server. The server gets so many requests all at once from so many different places. Dyn said they were seeing requests from tens of millions of discrete IP addresses from all around the world. So the servers get so many requests that they're, as you say, gummed up and can't process like they normally do and shut down or like come to a halt.
Okay. So here we are in the Internet of Things. The difference here was the new face here is that this wasn't computers taken over. They have better security by and large. This was all the stuff around the house that now includes thermostats and security systems and security cameras and, I don't know, the coffee maker, the fridge, the garage door opener, you name it. Right?
Yeah. So traditionally, DDoS attacks find huge banks of unsecure computers, right? And they bring them into this network and then they launch a DDoS attack. But that's a lot harder than, say, finding these little gizmos. There's billions of potentially unsecure gizmos all around the world. and that are totally susceptible to attack because, you know, we're kind of in a new era of Internet of Things, and I don't think a lot of these manufacturers have really considered the security of these devices. So traditionally, it's really hard to get, you know, a lot of computers on a massive DDoS network that's able to take down DYN, but it seems, you know, the new era that we're in is that you're able to find all these unsecured devices very easily and very quickly and then launch this massive attack.
And the number of these unsecured devices seems very likely to grow. I mean, this is where everything seems to be headed. Everyone's talking about the Internet of Things where everything is wired in. Uh-huh. Practically every little thing has an IP address.
Right. Yeah. So just about everything now has some internet capability, and manufacturers want to implement the internet into everything now. You see fridges that have, you know, internet connections and web browsers, which I guess is the future that we're living in. But that means that these devices, you know, have security flaws and can be taken over and utilized in a massive botnet. So I really think the onus here is on the manufacturers of these devices to, you know, not make basic mistakes, like have a hardwired password that's the same for all devices and, you know, easily discoverable.
Okay, but now we get down to it. I mean, this could just sound like a weird thing that happened on a Friday. But in fact, this is about the internet functioning and society, right. Business, culture, everything has come to depend on that. Individual computers are certainly raidable. We know that. They're hackable 60,000 different ways. But the Internet of Things has been described as wildly insecure, which means if you can assemble a botnet army there that can attack the internet, then the internet is wildly insecure if it's vulnerable to that. And do these manufacturers really have an incentive to change? I mean, they just want to sell you your router or your webcam or whatever it may be for the lowest price. Do they really want to mess around with high security?
So, yeah, I mean, I would assume that they would now. You know, they saw this massive attack that took down large swaths of the internet for people all across the United States and in some parts of Europe, and now this Chinese manufacturer has to recall their products. So I think, you know,
who says they have to? They didn't have to.
Sure, right. But, you know, I think they were kind of forced by, you know, like what might have come if they hadn't issued a recall on their products that were being used in this massive attack that took down a major piece of internet infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, companies, there's certainly some technology companies that pride themselves on having security in their devices. But I think at the end of the day, they don't want to read the headlines where, you know, millions of the devices that they sold to consumers are secretly being used in an attack to take down a major piece of internet infrastructure.
William Turton, stand by there. It's great to have you with us from Gizmodo.
Thanks.
We're joined right now as well by Ann Baron DiCamillo. She's Chief Technology Officer at Strategic Cyber Ventures. She was former Director of United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team, U.S. CERT. This is right up at the top of the U.S. government from 2013 to 2016. Ann Baron DiCamillo, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me today. So
who would want to do this? We're reading a lot of speculation that this is too big an operation for just some hacker in the basement, that this might well be a nation state probing, testing to see how they could take down the internet. Does it look that way to you?
So it definitely has some similarities to those types of activities where you're basically seeing what kind of reaction do you get, what kind of sustained attack do I have to perform in order to have my, you know, affected outcome that I'm looking towards. So you've seen these, or we've seen these kinds of things in the past where different adversarial groups will test, you basically use a playbook to test things out ahead of the full-on attack. The other important part of this is that attribution this early in the game can be very difficult and can often be wrong. So I would hate to jump to any conclusions because this infrastructure can be used by so many different adversaries. A lot of this infrastructure is widely known in the adversarial world, and it's easy to hide your activity by using known infrastructure from another nation state group.
I'm reading here Bruce Schneer, well-known big security voice in the internet world. The headline on his piece is, "Someone is learning how to take down the internet." And here's what he writes, Anne. He says, "It feels like a nation's military cyber command trying to calibrate its weaponry in the case of cyber war. It reminds me, he writes, of the U.S. Cold War program of flying high-altitude planes over the Soviet Union to force their air defense system to turn on to map their capabilities, i.e., you do this on a Friday in October, and yeah, down comes Reddit and Twitter and PayPal and CNN. But on another occasion, down could come the entire web. Does that seem like reasonable, informed speculation to you, Anne?
It definitely seems like informed speculation, but again, I would emphasize the speculation portion of that. There's a number of reasons why. I think the commodity associated with the malware that was leveraged to create this bot is so widely available to the point that anybody using Google can find this kind of malware and download it and leverage it.
You think this was just kids sitting in the rec room doing this, got bored with Grand Theft Auto?
Not saying it's kids, but I think the frightening part of this is that kids could be doing it. So don't want to jump to a conclusion that it's nation state, because the malware is so easily accessible by so many different players with so many different, you know, outcomes that they're looking to achieve. I think the important part to your earlier caller was that, your earlier guest was that we really need to work with vendors to harden these devices so that they're not susceptible to this commodity malware that can be accessed and leveraged by anybody. I think, you know, we have rushed these products to market without any kind of security design within them, and we're going to continue to see the exploit of those kinds of tool or these kinds of devices, because it's so easy. It's so easy to leverage this kind of malware to create this kind of bot and then easily point it at a target. We've got to change that, and we've got to change that starting with the vendors that are putting out these products.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Friday's digital attack that shut down a chunk of the American internet, a big denial-of-service attack launched through webcams and DVRs, the Internet of Things, and what it may mean for the future of the web. You can join us this hour. Did you think this was possible or that easy to knock out so many major sites right out of commission? Were you surprised to hear that the attack was launched through the Internet of Things? Can we ever nail that down, make that secure? And who would want to do this? Why? Are you thinking bored hacker, Russia, China? Have we outsmarted ourselves with all this linked technology, which makes it a lot of convenience and at the same time, everything vulnerable? Here's Kyle York. He's chief strategy officer at Dyn. That's a company that got hit, and through that, all these websites. He said the attack on the company's servers turned everyday connected devices found in people's homes into attackers. He talked with NBC on Sunday.
Basically, goes into folks' homes and takes over Internet of Things devices and literally turns them into attack vectors.
William Turton is with us from Gizmodo. Ann Baron DiCamillo is with us. She's former director of the U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team up until very recently, now at Strategic Cyber Ventures. We've got our whole economy built on this thing, and you've got commodity malware. That means stuff anybody can go out and download, and with just a little bit of insight, take a whole lot down. Dylan's calling from Austin, Texas. Dylan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm an internet security professional myself, and I've been actually waiting for kind of an opposite thing of somebody coming in and turning all of the refrigerators off or jacking up thermostats or jacking down to actually, you know, cause chaos that way. This DDoS attack was kind of a novel approach from what I've been thinking of. But, there are just so many ways that these devices can be owned by a hacker, and chaos thrown in one way or another, just playing with these toys. And there's a lot of people out there who are embracing the Internet of Things who do not, they're not at all aware of the fact that, yeah, it's a computer, but it is also sensitive to this kind of attack.
Well, of course, it's linked up, but does it surprise you that somebody would get in there and turn all these into weapons quietly in people's homes?
That it doesn't surprise me so much as it wasn't something I had considered, but that is that once again, it's a computer, and a computer can get owned by a hacker, and why not use it that way as opposed to trying to get some malware onto one of the computers here in my office.
Right, a more sophisticated computer.
And run it instead of bought that way.
Yeah, and we're told that this is the future. I mean, that we're led to expect, William, that more and more items in our home will be wired up. Let me get one more, and I'll turn to you. Dayton, Ohio. Wayne, you're on the air. Thank you for calling, Wayne.
Yes, hi, Tom. To me, it seems like Mr. Robot's meeting the Borg here from Star Trek. If we're worried and concerned about simple household items in the Internet of Things, I think we should eliminate them from being accessible in that way. I think we can go back to some earlier technology and RCF, radio control frequencies, and have access within a very narrow, limited perimeter. 25 feet within your distance of your house, you can access your thermostat. But beyond that, no one will have access because it's not on the Internet. I think we have to scale back our level of convenience and still use technology, but we're never going to get on top of the security issue. We just need to limit the access, and I think RCFs are the way to go.
You cut right to the chase there, Wayne, and I want to bring that right up with Ann and William. I mean, Ann, what about it? The Internet of Things, the whole idea is that you can control it. You can set the thermostat from work. You can be quite remote and deal with it. Is there an economic dynamic that could be a dynamic in the economy that could be changed here to turn back that anticipation, to keep it, let's say, to radio controlled frequency controls? If you do that, can I still do it from the office? Can somebody do it from, adjust my fridge from Palo Alto so that everything is hunky-dory? Or is that just not the way expectations are rolling in?
It was a great question, and I agree with Wayne's comment that this seems like a Mr. Robot episode. That the earlier caller had talked about how can all these devices be turned on to heating them to the point where things start to have a devastating effect.
Mm-hmm.
These are all concerns that have been part of the security community with the rush and the volume of Internet of Things connected devices. Going back, I'm not a big proponent in moving backwards, but I think working with the vendor community manufacturers to ensure that as they're developing these devices, they're developing it in a way with security in mind, and then also ensuring that there's a true need to have these devices connected to the Internet. Do I need to have some of these things that I use in my everyday life, do I need to have that access, or is it something that a manufacturer is just doing to keep up with a competitor? Do users really require that, I think, is another fundamental question that kind of gets to that point as well. I think a lot of times because we can doesn't mean we should. And so is there a real need for all of these things to be connected to the Internet? And if so, doing it in a way that is security design in mind with an ability to harden the credentials associated with these devices and then ensure that they are patched, because a lot of these devices have vulnerabilities almost the second that they hit the Internet that can be exploited. And so these are all considerations that we need to make to make sure that we're not making this problem worse, that we're thinking about how to make it better.
We'll look at that. William Turton, this idea of limiting connectedness seems to just fly in the face of what the tsunami has been for years now and the expectation of the future that every little thing everywhere would be connected to the Internet practically. I mean, we're talking about little plugs in trees out in the woods so rangers can... I mean, that's the vision that's been laid out right here on this show. Do you see that turning around because of security concerns?
Right. I think Wayne's idea is certainly interesting, and it would probably make things more secure. But I think the reality is that we can't put the genie back in the bottle. These Internet-connected devices are now becoming a huge market. Consumers demand them. And big players like Google are in the market selling, Internet-connected thermostats. So, unfortunately, I just don't think there's any way to go back. And I feel like the smarter approach is to, have these devices and, have really interesting, innovative technologies that make our lives a little bit cooler, a little bit more interesting, but also at the same time make sure these devices are secure and, not utilized in a massive botnet to take down major internet infrastructure. So, there's no way we're moving away from internet-connected devices. I think consumers are really enamored with them. We're just going to have to make them more secure.
But now we've been shown on Friday how they can be taken en masse and turned into this big howitzer, this big threat where you could essentially, the speculation is here, you could shut down the entire Internet, which would shut down that's the economy. It's hard to that gets up to the level of, you heard Bruce, I read you here, Bruce Schneer speculating about cyber war, full-on cyber war. William Turton and Baron DiCamillo, please stand by. Kevin Beaumont joins us right now via Skype from Liverpool, England. He's an IT security architect, designs, researches, builds, supports IT security. Kevin Beaumont, thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to talk to you, Tom.
Can this vulnerability be addressed at a technology level? Does it have to be addressed just at a manufacturing level, like change the way you put the settings or somehow the security on all these devices? Will it require government intervention to require that? Because I'm reading widely here that market economics will not drive manufacturers of all these little devices to spend more on security.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. If you look at the botnet that caused the attack on Friday, is being attributed to by Dyn, a botnet called Mirai.
This is the so-called commodity malware that Anne was talking about that anybody can download and use.
Yeah, so the scary situation is that anybody can go on Google and download the source code to this because it's been released on the internet, and they can run it from their home PCs, and it will go and find these devices on the internet. So it searches for common passwords and then takes ownership of these devices, and then they can be used to launch attacks. So there's lots of different threads to this issue, but one of the interesting ones for me is that you've got a divide between, you know, on one hand, it could be a nation state trying to attack core components and effect of the internet. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it could be a teenager in a bedroom, and we don't know yet where that line is drawn. And that, to me, is a significant concern because, you know, we're whole economies are effectively migrating towards the internet. Like, it's a critical part of our infrastructure worldwide.
Yeah.
So we can't have a situation where these devices are just left on the internet, and there's, in my mind at least, and there's no plan as to, you know, how to require device manufacturers to better secure the connections to them.
And suddenly, a nation state can go here, shut down another country's economy if they put this to work, or an individual, you're saying, everybody can be a little Lex Luthor, a little evil genius sitting in their basement with commodity malware.
This is the interesting thing. I mean, there's a Twitter account that somebody set up called Mirai Attacks, and you can follow that account, and they've introduced a honeypot into this botnet, which is a security term for like a device that is deliberately got a bad username and password set so that it gets infected with different attacks and effectively tweets the attacks. So it doesn't really take part in the attacks, but it tweets what's being attacked. So that's live now. So you can go and see what websites are being attacked.
So what is the point of that? To give us a heads up when attack is going on?
Well, it's interesting in that it goes on all the time. Like, as we're on air, attacks are going on right now. And quite often they're against, for example, I don't know if you've heard of a computer program or a game called Minecraft.
Yes, of course, yeah.
One of the things that we've seen that this particular botnet since Friday heavily attacks Minecraft servers, which is something that...
That does not seem like a nation state would be interested in that.
Exactly. Other things are, for example, users on Skype attacking each other. The data that's coming through... it makes me question, you know, if people have that kind of power and can just go online and download these kind of tools, then for years in the security community, we've been talking about how the Internet of Things is making the Internet more vulnerable. Like, there's a great tweet I saw the other day from somebody saying how the Internet was designed to be this resource that's, you know, can deal with natural disaster, nuclear war. It's been shown over the years that where there's been natural disasters in certain countries, the internet has transparently, you know, rooted around that.
But now it can't deal with wired coffee pots and refrigerators and thermostats.
In the space of a few years, we've reduced that to a situation where, you know, people can go online and download a code that can attack, you know, a critical part of the internet, DNS. And... you know, it's okay talking about it within the security community, but I think personally it needs to be broadened out to governments to say, okay, what incentives can we provide to companies that are making these kind of devices? And can we work with internet service providers to bring them in as well and give them part of the role around what kind of traffic they send?
We're going to dig in on that front. It was a big aha moment on Friday when everybody witnessed this. We're looking at it. So, Kevin and Anne, let's dig in on this. What it would take to get manufacturers of this huge array of products that will be part of the Internet of Things, already are, what would it take to get them to really upgrade their security systems to put this kind of threat to bed? I mean, Anne, you say that's the way to go. What would that require? Is that going to require a big new round of laws, legislation, to say if you want to sell these anything that's hooked up to the Internet, it's going to have meet all these regulations in terms of security profile? What would it take, Anne?
I'm not a big proponent of regulating this. I think sometimes the regulations you see around specifically things that have to do with cyber quickly get out of date. So what I would propose instead is doing some kind of a positive endeavor where you can create a community that wants to engage in this. And I think some type of tax benefit could also be another mechanism. I think that when you incentivize from a positive perspective, it keeps pace, first of all, with the changes that happen in the landscape. And it doesn't have this, effect where these regulations sometimes become out of date and it takes years for governments to change them. I think FISMA is a great example of, it was passed in 2002 and it wasn't updated until 2015. I think I would hate to see something like this regulated because it just doesn't keep pace with the change, the cyber landscape changes that are evolving, so quickly. So I think, some type of tax incentive, creating communities that are empowered to basically leverage that your competitors is doing this, and basically maybe even a certification that you abide by a standard, and that's almost like a good housekeeping seal. There's a number of ways that this could be addressed without having to regulate.
I get the attraction of doing it without regulation, but then you could still have billions of little devices out there. And, even if you have a tax incentive in the United States, I guess they don't have to be in the United States in order to be targeting U.S. or others. I mean, Kevin, can you do this just with positive incentives?
It's an interesting question. You're quite right with the assertion that a lot of these devices are outside the U.S. In fact, I'd say a majority of the devices that are involved in these kind of attacks quite often are outside the U.S. So it has an impact on the U.S. So that's something that needs addressing. From my point of view, there's small technical changes that manufacturers could do. And the key question is, how do you get manufacturers to look at those kind of areas? I think a lot of it's education where, for example, if the cameras potentially that we used on Friday's attack, if before internet access or remote access was available, if the user had to change a default password and there wasn't any kind of hard-coded password in those devices, then that, those devices couldn't be used in that kind of attack. So I suppose the core question is, can we get manufacturers on board with doing things in that area?
But how do you do that when somebody goes to the store to buy a router or a camera or whatever it may be, and one is $99 and it's not secure, the other one is, $159 and it is secure, everybody buys the $99 one and security be damned.
To give an example on that front, on Friday, as this attack was ongoing, at first, I live in England, and first it didn't impact me, so I could still see Twitter, which was how I was able to start researching this topic. Mm-hmm. And then later that day, it did impact me. And one of the things I noticed as this attack was starting in the US, the number one selling webcam product that I could see on Amazon was these cameras.
Wow. Even as thousands more going off the shelves. Of course, Amazon was hit too, so maybe they weren't selling anymore on that day.
Well, the interesting thing as well, you can go on Google and find statistics around the Mirai botnet that was used in this. You can go online and see those stats. And what you'll see is that the number of infected devices has actually risen since the product recall.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about Friday's digital attack that shut down a big chunk of the American internet and beyond, a big denial of service attack launched through webcams and DVRs, the Internet of Things. And we're looking at what that means for the future of the web. Anne Baron DiCamillo is with us, Chief Technology Officer at Strategic Cyber Ventures. She, from 2013 to 16, was director of the U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team. They look at this from a national level, a federal level. William Turton is here. He writes on cybersecurity for the tech website Gizmodo. Kevin Beaumont joins us from Liverpool, England, big IT security architect there, looks at, researches, builds, supports IT security. What do you see here? Do you wonder if the appliances in your home have now been weaponized? And what does this mean when our entire economy and more is now built on the web? And all these little gizmos can help take it down. We're going to look in a moment at the proposed AT&T Time Warner merger. But first, right here, Ann, William, Kevin, lots of response online. Citizen James says, this hacking does not come from some kids in the basement. I'm concerned that this is a precursor to hacking the election results on November 8th. People's worries go wide in a hurry. Hello Kitty writes here, I'm sorry, but my fridge does not need the internet. It just doesn't. And Peter writes the same on Twitter, says, my fridge makes ice and keeps stuff cold. I don't need internet connectivity in that. Some things are better left dumb. But then we've got this from our website. If these devices are so easy to hack and then shut down the internet, does it become a matter of national security? Does this mean they need to be regulated? Does it mean they'll have to submit their devices to the government so the government can make sure they're developed with proper encryption before they're released to the public, like drugs and the FDA, like emission standards and cars? William Turton, does that make sense to you?
I think it's a really difficult question to answer. And I think Anne had a great point in that regulation probably wouldn't keep up with this. You know, the reality is that our Congress is inept when it comes to technology, and especially really sophisticated technology like this. So the chances of them proposing legislation, getting legislation passed that's actually effective and solves this problem, I'd say, is probably minimal. What we should do is we should incentivize, you know, these manufacturers to practice better security practices and make these devices more secure. And I think, you know, if these manufacturers eliminate a hardwired password and require users to set their own password, these devices would become infinitely more secure than they are now. So the change is actually, you know, not some major shift that we have to make in these devices. It's just, you know, we have to move away from these hardwired default passwords and make every user set their own password on a device.
And maybe that would get us closer to something like security. But boy, what a vulnerability we saw. Suzanne in Iowa City. Thanks for calling, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wondered if any of your guests have any of these internet-connected devices in their own homes, and whether or not they think any particular device or manufacturer is better in terms of security.
Ann, what do you say? Do you have them in your own home? Do we all at this point, or not necessarily? And what about different brands?
So I'm not going to get into brands. I always try to stay vendor agnostic on that. But I definitely think that there are, I definitely have a number of these devices. And then to William's point, the devices that I have in my home, I've ensured that I can access their credentials, and not just using passwords, but if I can even leverage multi-factor authentication is even better. I think a lot of the...
You mean so every time you go on your smart TV, you've got to like...
No. It's only if you're accessing it from an unknown device.
Okay.
So if I'm accessing it from my laptop or from my my phone, it's a known device, and the credentials are associated with that. So understanding the kinds of things you're buying, and to your point earlier, is it a $99 camera that has no security, or am I buying something that maybe costs $20 more but has the ability for me to manage the credentials? As a consumer, you know, those are choices that you can make, and things that you can, those are, you know, risk decisions that you make as an individual. But I think the larger problem is that we're putting this into the hands of consumers, and most consumers don't even know how to access these credentials and wouldn't even know to ask those questions. So I think we really need to continue to focus on the vendor manufacturer community to really build this in, security by design. And another point that hasn't been brought up that I think is interesting in this whole discussion is that DNS was developed in the 1980s. The infrastructure that's underlying this attack that was the focus of what happened on Friday, you know, it needs to be updated for today's internet. A lot of aspects of the infrastructure of the internet need to be updated. The internet was never created with security and by design. And so there's things that also need to be to be addressed by government and by regulation if you're going to look towards that as a mechanism to address some of these things that we saw on Friday.
I mean, Kevin, look at this. I'm not persuaded that we're going to keep up with the pace of the threat here. You know, here it was Friday, and suddenly we realize all this vulnerability. We're talking about putting out incentives and tax changes that might get manufacturers to change. Things like that take years to really come to fruition. And, you know, we've got people speculating that this could have been a nation state probing, you know, and our callers are worried about the election in the U.S. And I mean, are we just sitting here kind of naked right now, Kevin, and vulnerable to tomorrow or today having the whole thing locked up, shut down?
In a word, and I don't, you know, as a rule, I don't like to sound alarmist, but in a simple answer to your question, yes, the problem that existed on Friday still exists today. I would imagine that, and you can see from the statistics online from people who are tracking this botnet, there's actually more members of the botnet now than there was on Friday. So these devices are largely still out there. So It's an interesting debate, and it's been one that we've been having in the security community for years, although it's happening on a much wider scale now, which is great.
Do you think it looks like a nation-state player last week, or are you sticking with the, hacker who's playing Lex Luthor?
It's impossible to tell because there's not enough data as to the source of the attacks. One of the interesting things about it is that the type of attack that was launched, which is a DNS attack, in the source code of this botnet, you can spoof the origin. So although Dyn is saying that 10 million devices attack them, or 10 million plus devices attack them, anybody running that attack can spoof the address that they're coming from. So it's one of those things where I think, personally, it could have been retargeted at potentially bigger parts of the internet.
Could have. And maybe people were testing. Maybe just testing to see how it worked. But who knows what the target will be next time. We're out of time right there on this subject, but we're not finished with this. William Turton, it makes me want to go back and, I don't know, have a little charcoal grill and live in the woods. no Internet of Things required.
Yeah, a little bit of peace, finally.
A little bit of peace. We get very fancy and suddenly, whoops, it's all brought down. Let's hope not, but there's the vulnerability. I want to thank all three of you. William Turton at Gizmodo, thank you so much for being
Thanks
with
so
us
much.
From New York today. And Ann Baron DiCamillo in New York at Strategic Cyber Ventures. Thank you very much, Ann.
Thank you.
Kevin Beaumont with us today from Liverpool, England. Kevin, you're terrific. Come again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, we'll dig into the AT&T Time Warner deal. This is On Point. Okay, an $85 billion AT&T deal for Time Warner is in the works. On Saturday, the two companies announced the largest media merger since AOL and Time Warner in 2001. The companies say the deal makes strategic sense, but it's raising scrutiny among politicians and regulators and more who say that AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner with its CNN, HBO, and more brings up antitrust issues. So is the merger a good idea, a bad idea, and what comes next? Joining me now from New York is Keech Hagee, media reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's been following the AT&T Time Warner merger very closely. Keech Hagee, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Okay, so first of all, why would these two giants want to get even more ginormous, merge?
Well, both AT&T and Time Warner are facing a really challenging media environment where people's behavior is rapidly changing. So people are increasingly watching video on their phones, on mobile devices. That's sort of the big picture. If you zoom in a little bit more, you see AT&T's core business, wireless, is there's just not a lot of growth there. That's stalled. So they have needed to go to other places, like to buy DirecTV last year, for example. And Time Warner's business, although, you know, their results have been good, long-term, they're also facing a really rough environment. People are cutting the cord. They're getting rid of their expensive cable packages. And the future was maybe not as bright for them as it had been in the past.
So on the one hand, AT&T with all that wireless service and DirecTV. Under Time Warner's umbrella, you've got, I mean, the big names would help us understand what all is in there. CNN is in there. HBO is in there. Warner, the movie studios are in there. What else that would be of interest here?
Right. Well, the Turner Broadcasting, so CNN is part of that, but you have TBS, TNT, Cartoon Network. And then inside Warner Brothers, I mean, that's, you know, a giant engine that puts on the largest number of broadcast TV shows, like The Big Bang Theory, as well as the movie studio. So it's definitely a highly desirable asset, some of the most premium content that exists, which is another reason why it's a good time to sell, because there are not very many assets out there like that.
So if they got connected, if they merge, what sort of things in business operations terms or what sort of strategic benefits would come out of that? What might we see them doing that can't be done now because they're two different companies?
So the companies themselves say the benefits will be kind of around the edges. Things like we'll have a bunch of access to data, which will help us deliver advertising that targets people's, you know, needs and desires a little bit more specifically. Or because we'll know more about people's viewing behavior, we'll be able to make better content. We'll be able to negotiate deals where you can be watching a show on your phone and clip little bits of it and share it with your friends without having to negotiate a bunch of difficult rights deals. That's sort of their dream. It's going to be difficult for them to do that. But the obvious thing that you think that they would be able to do, which is let you, say, watch HBO without being charged for your data cap for the data it takes, they're not really going to be able to do that kind of stuff, at least not exclusively.
Why not?
For a couple of reasons, both regulatory and business reasons, and really the biggest reason is that they can't afford to. Time Warner makes a lot of money from selling its content to a bunch of different distributors. And if all of a sudden AT&T were to say, you know, stop doing that, they would stop getting all this cash flow from Time Warner, which they really need to service the debt that they took out to buy the company in the first place.
Yeah.
So there's a business reason, and then there's, you know, the regulatory reasons have been getting a lot of scrutiny lately. The rules, you know, are evolving in this space, but generally speaking, people in Washington do not look kindly on that kind of exclusivity of the pipes.
Washington. I mean, and the bigger picture, people saying if this happens, the next thing you know, it'll be Comcast and T-Mobile, it'll be Fox and Sky. What do they need in terms of antitrust approval? What's the process now, Keith?
It's going to be a long slog, at least a year, probably more. They're going to have to get through the Justice Department, of course. There is going to be some FCC review, and they're still sort of figuring out what that's going to be. They have the benefit of there's no broadcast network within Time Warner, which makes that a pretty unusual media company. Most of them do have a broadcast network, and those are really heavily regulated, and the FCC will get in there and put lots of conditions around things that have broadcast networks. But there are a few broadcast licenses. So it's going to be the FCC. It's going to be the Justice Department. You know, the Senate Subcommittee on Antitrust said over the weekend that they're going to take a look at it. So there are going to be a lot of voices trying to put conditions on this thing as it moves through.
As AT&T tries to merge with Time Warner and by that pull Harry Potter into its orbit and Game of Thrones into its orbit, there was a lot of political feedback on this. Donald Trump right away in Gettysburg on Saturday. Here he was. Too much, he said.
AT&T is buying Time Warner and thus CNN, a deal we will not approve in my administration because it's too much concentration of power in the hands of too few.
There's the Republican candidate and the Democratic vice presidential nominee, Tim Kaine. Here he was with NBC on Sunday.
Generally, pro-competition and less concentration, I think, is generally helpful, especially in the media.
Keech Hagee covers all this for the Wall Street Journal. So what about the arguments here for and against this merger when you get into that framework? How do they look, Keech? What's strong? What's weak?
So the arguments for it that companies are making is that this is what they call a vertical merger, not a horizontal merger, meaning this is a distributor of content buying its supplier. So they aren't taking competition out of the marketplace. The world is going to look very similar after this thing finishes as far as who can buy what from whom. And in the past, those kind of mergers have been approved. We saw Comcast buy NBC Universal. There were conditions placed on it, but, you know, that went through. The argument against it, I would say, has a lot to do with the climate in Washington right now. As you hear on both sides of the aisle, there's a general fear of consolidation of media power and just consolidation in general. You know, a lot of big mergers have been blocked, and there's a sense there's a much tougher regulatory environment today than there was a few years back when Comcast bought NBC Universal.
And if I'm not a politician or a big shareholder, if I'm a regular consumer, I mean, I still have an interest in the health of the economy. I still have an interest in politics. But where's the consumer interest here?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people have been asking, what's this going to do to prices? And I don't have a crystal ball on that. I really don't know. It's hard to see, really, what it's going to do to prices. We just really don't know enough yet. The companies are making an argument that for the consumer, you're going to have a lot more flexibility in the kind of viewing packages you can access. A little bit, I think, if you try to watch TV today, it is a pretty frustrating experience. It's hard to know where to find what shows and who has what rights to what shows and where you can go find the libraries, meaning, you know, the old episodes of certain shows, because there's so many rights negotiations. And the companies are arguing that this is going to be able to slice through a little bit of that. I'm skeptical of it, but if they could do that, then that would really radically change the viewing experience for consumers.
But by that argument, the consumer would be better off with just one big media company straddling the entire planet. And you could have everything, but they could charge you whatever they like. They could, you know, tailor programming however they liked. I mean, consolidation has its own problems, doesn't it?
Well, in general, yes, there's a fear that it raises prices, diminishes competition, and raises prices, not to mention when you get into ownership of journalism and news outlets, that it kind of quashes voices and diversity of voices in the marketplace. So there are real concerns about it. It gets really complicated when you talk about a vertical one like this, because, you know, who really knows what that's going to do to the voices? There's been a lot of questions about what it's going to look like for AT&T, essentially the phone company, to own CNN, which is what's going to happen. They've put out statements saying we respect the journalistic integrity of CNN. We're not going to meddle with it. But,
we'll see. And soon, Kichegi, we're out of time right there. Kichegi with the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for that. We'll be watching. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.